Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-7042, Jorge Vila versus Inter-American Investment Corporation Appellant. Ms. Perkins for the appellant, Mr. Hartnett for the appellee.
Good morning. Please the court. My name is Nancy Perkins. I represent the Inter-American Investment Corporation, the IIC, in this action. I'm here with my colleague Ian Hoffman, who is with me on the brief. As you know, there are two questions in this appeal. First, whether the IIC is immune from Vila's claim of unjust enrichment. Second, whether that claim is barred by the applicable statute of limitations, which under D.C. law is 3 years. First, I'll address the immunities issue. It's undisputed that the IIC is absolutely immune from suit under federal law, the International Organizations Immunities Act. However, the IIC may waive its immunity to suit, and this court has construed certain language that appears in the immunities section of the charter of the organization as constituting such a waiver, but only in very limited circumstances. Specifically, the court has determined, as articulated in the Mandaro case and the Atkinson case and other cases, that the charter provision may be construed as a waiver to suit if, and only if, the organization would have to subject itself to suit in order to achieve its chartered objectives. In other words, the organization's immunity should be construed as not waived unless the particular type of suit would further the organization's objectives.
Do you agree that we must take the allegations of the complaint as true in terms of reviewing this decision under Rule 12b-6?
In terms of the allegations, in terms of the factual allegations of the complaint, yes. I think the court may consider facts outside of the allegations of the complaint to determine jurisdiction. There are, however, I do not believe any disputed facts in that regard. As a court,
can I try to
certainly
reformulate the Mandaro test, see if you agree? It seemed to me that the question that Mandaro puts in every one of these cases is, ex ante, will exposure to this type of suit on net benefit the institution?
Yes, I completely agree, and I think that the court very well articulated that in the recent Osirin case in terms of the whether the type of plaintiff and the type of suit would benefit the organization to have a waiver over the long term.
Okay.
So in this case, we ask.
So that's why I was focusing on the allegations of the complaint. In your brief, you suggest that where someone volunteers his activity, that could be of no benefit to the organization because the organization already has a contractual procedure whereby it can hire consultants, and it has that arbitration clause that should satisfy any concerns about attraction of such consultants. But that's not the allegation in this complaint, is it?
I think the focus is the type of plaintiff. There is no dispute that we have a consultant here, and the type of suit, unjust enrichment. It is true that there are factual elements, there are factual circumstances that need to be taken into consideration, such as the arbitration provision in the prior agreements, which
is
certainly part of the record.
Is that the allegation is he was specifically requested by officials who had the authority to make these requests to do certain activities on behalf of the organization. So he's not in the posture of a volunteer, is he?
I think that the focus is whether he is a volunteer or, I mean, certainly that's a disputed fact, whether he was a volunteer or he wasn't a volunteer.
Well, I started out by saying, do you agree we have to take the allegations of the complaint?
Yes, and we do agree that we must take the allegations of the complaint as true. What the issue in terms of determining the immunities is whether he would have to be able to sue for whether in order to attract him to be a consultant, which is essentially the court was thinking about in terms of, you know, the relationship of the necessity of a waiver, whether he would need to know that he could sue to be paid for services performed outside of a contract. And I think one way to think about
outside of a written contract.
Outside of an agreement.
Outside of a legally binding contract.
In terms of suit for unjust enrichment, legally binding agreement.
He alleges there was an oral contract.
The district court found otherwise.
The claim is unjust enrichment, which doesn't in any way depend on a contract.
Precisely.
Let me ask, I'm sorry, were you done?
Yes, please.
You were? Okay. I'm wondering whether Mendaro has already taken the key step here. Mendaro says that there's no immunity for breach of contract suits in commercial transactions with the outside world. So your client is already subject to suit for a breach of contract. So having taken that step in Mendaro and in Osarin, having extended it beyond written contracts to promissory estoppel, and said, quote, promises founded on good faith alone are worth less than obligations enforceable in court. Having taken all those steps, how do we draw the line now at promissory estoppel?
I think there are two answers to that question. Uh-huh. And the first is that the type of plaintiff, you referred to commercial transactions with the outside world. I think that it's incorrect to characterize a consultant of the IIC as someone who's in a quote-unquote commercial transaction with the outside world within the meaning of Mendaro, and in particular the similarity between what a consultant does and an employee does. In other words, Mendaro was distinguishing, and of course that language...
Mendaro talked about... office equipment, supplies, telephone and utilities. Your point is consultants are different from that?
My point is, well, first, that was dicta, and I don't believe the court, you know, was dealing with particular situations.
Well, but you're not arguing that your client would be immune from a breach of contract suit, are you?
I think it does depend on the particular type of plaintiff and the particular type of circumstance.
Uh-huh. Well, how fine-grained does it get? Because Osarin, it seemed to me, quite rightly said that the fact that the institution has a great defense is irrelevant. Right?
Yes.
So, I mean... I guess it had seemed to me that, although there's certainly some sort of interest in Mendaro on the type of plaintiff, I'm not sure exactly how one weaves that in, but it was primarily the type of lawsuit, and I can see a way in which causes of action in general can be divided as between ones which the potential defendant would want to be exposed to and ones that the potential defendant never want to be exposed to. If you start dividing it up by not only the cause of action and the type of plaintiff, but the specific facts, then every such suit is going to dissolve into a very complex matter before you even get to the, quote, merits, unquote.
Yes, I agree. I do think, though, that it's important in this case to recognize that a consultant, on those two points, the type of plaintiff and the type of suit, that a consultant acts very much like an employee of the ISC or other international organizations in terms of the relationship to what Mandaro was thinking about, the important thing about performing functions and achieving the objectives of the organization. Employees, after all, the court found in Mandaro, there is no waiver to suit even with respect to breach of contract actions. Yet employees are certainly more critical to the organization's function than consultants.
Mandaro also said that employees were protected by the arbitration procedures in the employment contract.
And that is where you find a precise parallel with what, as Vila has put in the record, the IIC does with consultants.
Yeah, but that's only for consultants who actually have contracts. I mean, take this case, for example. He did not have a contract, and he had no protection from those arbitration clauses.
With all due respect, Your Honor, I don't think that the internal tribunals of the international organizations apply to anyone who doesn't have a contract either. And I do think
No, you agree. Vila could not take advantage of those provisions, right? Because he didn't have
a contract. Certainly
not. Whereas any employee of the World Bank could.
Right, after becoming an employee.
Yeah. So the fact that you have internal arbitration proceedings doesn't respond to the concern raised in this case of the absence of any protection for someone who, like in this case, whose implied contract claim failed.
I think the question, Your Honor, is whether it would be sufficient to attract the consultants to become consultants in the first place,
right,
to have the assurance that as consultants under contract, they would have that recourse. And our position is that there's a balancing of two things. One is the need by the organization for the consultant in order to perform its functions, which is a very low need in this case.
Well, but you say in your brief that you say with respect to consultants, if you weren't allowed to use them, you would unnecessarily limit the IIC's flexibility with respect to performing its functions.
There's that is certainly correct. There
right.
is a flexibility and a usefulness of consultants. However, I do not believe that that usefulness translates into the type of necessity that the Mandaro case and its progeny discuss in terms of the need to be able to perform
the
functions.
There was the word necessity, but is there any other case that holds it has to be necessary? Don't we just say it has to be a corresponding benefit? I mean, we didn't say it was necessary.
True. The word was benefit. So, I think it's a balancing of benefits.
I don't know of any authority that says it has to be necessary. And given that, and given what you say in your reply brief about the value of consultants, aren't we faced with exactly the same situation in Oseran, which is that you've conceded that consultants are the absence of them would, quote, hamper the ability to perform its mission.
No, I do not believe. I do not believe we have gone so far as to say that their absence would hamper the ability. Uh-huh. There's a hampering of some flexibility, but not the hampering of the ability.
Uh-huh.
And I'd like to actually go back to Judge Williams' point about the type of suit, because I do think it's very important to distinguish the type of suit that was involved in the Oseran case and the type of suit we're talking about here. The ability of a consultant to be able to sue for payment when there is no agreement is not at all the same as the ability of an investor to be able to sue for promissory estoppel or breach of confidentiality in the context of negotiations over a contract. The reason the court found that there was a waiver in Oseran, to my reading, was that there is a necessary tie between the negotiation process and the contract itself. You're never going to get to a contract unless you sit down and negotiate. So it makes sense that an international organization would wish to waive its immunity to claims arising from that negotiation context. Why a potential consultant needs to perform services and allege that they benefited the organization and be paid for those without a contract in order to agree to enter into a contract for services seems to me wholly implausible.
Because maybe people wouldn't enter into contracts if they wouldn't do business as consultants, as in this case, if they thought that they wouldn't be paid if the contract claim failed. That's why.
I'm out of time. I don't know if you would like
you,
me to
you
respond.
Can certainly answer the question.
A consultant looking under the contract claim, as we've discussed, there's an arbitration recourse. Anything arising out of the contractual relationship.
Yeah, but that doesn't help you for people who are either in the process of negotiating a contract or who believe, as in this case, that they had a contract.
But the performance of services in that context is not necessary to enter into the contract. It's not like
you're
negotiation.
You're back to the world necessary now.
Yeah. All right. Why don't we hear from counsel for Appley, and you'll have give you a minute in response.
Your Honor, may it please the court. Of course, I was all prepared with lots to say, but I wanted to pick up right where your discussion with opposing counsel left off and make a couple points. One is that they seem to be very concerned about the importance of the consultant to the work or to the mission of the agency.
We're talking about a specific class of consultants. We're talking about a class of consultants who have not entered into a contract.
Right. And I would make two points about that. One is that in this case, the record clearly demonstrates how important Mr. Vila's work is. If you review the emails in the record, the attachments to the...
Is that the way this
and,
test
well,
is to
that's
be applied?
One
we look at the particular
no.
value of the plaintiff's services?
No, my point is that the appellant is claiming that it isn't that significant. In fact, it is very significant toward their mission. And the other point that I'd make... in response to your question is that they also seem very concerned that the waiver is construed as very narrow. Well, we're now talking about a class of consultants who, for whatever reason, may or may not have finalized an agreement. And so it is, even granting a waiver for an unjust enrichment claim like this is likely to be a very narrow class of potential plaintiffs.
The question is the benefits to the institution from exposure to litigation by all persons who assert such a claim versus the benefits of not being exposed to such claims.
Well, I would go back to Mandero, and Mandero, you know, listed telephones, as Judge Tittle said, that, you know, even things as mundane as that are actually important to their mission. And the point here is not that it's the contractual.
It's more important than the telephone company.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Provide your service
without a
contract to pay. And the telephone company invests money up front, uh-huh. which it wants to be assured of recovering.
Uh-huh. And a client like mine, who worked for 6 months without getting paid, has invested a significant amount of time. He also is functioning at a very high level within the agency.
There's an easy way for the bank to get the services of the people, and that is to enter in a contract with them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Well, a very easy way.
Yes, that's true. I mean,
given the ease of entering into a contract and the incremental value to the bank is the services of people who, but for liability, would be scared off. I guess it seems to be questionable how great that the value of those services of people who would be scared off by the banks being limited to mere contractual liability is.
Well, we have two examples, one as a consultant and one as a possible customer of the bank in the Osarian case, where those kinds of things exactly happened. I think Osarian is directly parallel to this case, and especially in the fact that, as Judge Tittle noticed, the contract claim ended up failing, and this court found that there was a waiver of immunity for the promissory estoppel. Unjust enrichment, promissory estoppel, those are commercial transaction kinds of cases that come out of...
Unjust enrichment often operate in the context of torts, such as a trespass, where a trespasser builds a few inches on the wrong side of the border, and if in good faith, and depends from state to state, may be protected. So there's not a shred of contract in sight in that particular type of unjust enrichment claim.
True. I mean, it's conceivable that unjust enrichment could occur outside of a commercial context. Yes.
You're talking about unjust. Your claim is unjust enrichment where no contract-like claim is viable, such as promissory estoppel. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? In the contract context, it's not good enough to make one of the claims that really sound in contract. And it's, the argument has to be that it's sufficiently to the benefit of the institution to be exposed to liability in those cases.
Well, and that's
to overcome the costs of
defending
against bad claims.
So we go back to Mendaro, which firmly established that the reason that they found a waiver there was because of the commercial transactions. And the other side of the Mendaro case, which we haven't talked about yet, if I could for a moment, is that the exposure, what the waiver exposes the entity to in both Mendaro and Atkinson, the claims were a Title VII claim, and I believe it was a claim attempting to force the bank to withhold wages for a plaintiff's spouse who worked at the bank. Those are clearly far afield from commercial transaction interactions between the bank and the outside world.
Well, you can hypothesize a theory by which an employer gains from voluntarily submitting to Title VII liability, right?
Certainly could. And if the bank wanted to voluntarily waive their immunity for that.
You seem to think that the possibility of merely hypothesizing some potential benefit from exposure to a particular type of liability, that's the end of the matter.
No, I'm sorry,
it seems to me that Mendaro clearly calls for some sort of balance.
I don't mean to say that they would benefit from subjecting or waiving their immunity to Title VII.
That enables them to attract people who otherwise might fear discrimination, right?
Well, I suppose that's true. But as we have in Mendaro, the line of cases clearly identifies commercial transactions as one of the areas that been a waiver, and
it doesn't address the question of transactions that never get completed at all, right? That don't result in a contract claim.
But I thought your point was that this case did result in a contract claim, an implied contract.
A contract claim, nevertheless,
right?
Which is quantum merit. Right. It's not a contract claim. It's historically like a contract claim, and it's clearly a commercial interaction.
Claims that the district court rejected?
They rejected tortious interference.
Defamation.
And defamation.
And the implied contract claim.
And the implied contract claim.
Yeah, so it seems to be a little odd to say this is really implied contract. I mean,
I'm just drawing a parallel between an unjust enrichment and a commercial transaction context.
It has to be the proposition that the institution will gain from being exposed to incomplete contracts where the claim is not good enough for implied contract, mm-hmm. but hypothetically is good enough for unjust enrichment.
The other side of the issue, I didn't quite get there, was the downside of the immunities and the reason that the bank was given immunity to prevent the kind of harassment from the member nations and subjecting themselves to all sorts of claims, like I would suggest this Title VII case. And in that case, in Mendaro, they reasoned that the reason this was so much of a problem for the bank is because it operated in so many countries that having personnel rules in all those different counties represented a big downside of waiving immunity. In an unjust enrichment case, no, there wasn't that issue, although it is, you know, the employee at the bank was not even, I mean, this was a third party, wasn't an employee, wasn't, and the bank was not at all involved in the underlying issue of the case. They were just being ordered by the state to withhold funds. And that's the kind of harassing, perhaps, or interference that the immunities was designed to protect. And it is quite dissimilar from what we have here, which is, as identified in Mendaro, the commercial transactions between the outside world and the bank. And I wanted to go back to the appellant's brief. They do actually, on page 11 of their reply brief, they do mention that the corresponding benefit. Where is it? I'm sorry. It would limit the IEC's flexibility with respect to performing its functions contrary to the objectives of the IIC member nations. I think that's pretty clear that they're saying.
The argument is that far from facilitating the IIC's dealing with consultants, uh-huh. exposure to liability here would, at least at the margin, tend to make it turn its back on that kind of relationship.
And that represents, you know, a flip and an inconsistency from their previous arguments about why Mr. Mendaro or Mr. Vila's activities were unimportant to the bank as a consultant.
I don't really understand the unimportant argument, but the clear point here is that apart from the costs of litigation, mm-hmm. exposure to liability would entail, I mean, I don't know how convincing it is, but the argument is certainly that it would tend to make the bank give up a particular practice. Far from facilitating use of the practice, it would make it give it up.
Clearly, any waiver that subjects them to some kind of liability is a disincentive for them to engage in that activity. The fact that they actually get sued is not relevant
to
the benefit.
We're talking about exposure to mm-hmm. liability mm-hmm. at the point before the relationship is broken down.
Right, and the balance of the benefit that the bank gets from it. And my point when I keep talking about the importance is that the balance of the benefit that the bank gets from these kinds of consultants is significant. My client was directly and involved in the top levels of syndicating loans for the bank. This is not, a minor practice. So when the appellants argue that consultants really aren't that important, the facts don't bear that out. And so, therefore, the corresponding benefit of waiving immunity for this kind of transaction becomes much more significant. They're tending to downplay the benefit they get out of this and trying to upplay, the downside of it. And I think there's significant evidence in the record that that's not the case. And when you add on top of that, that Mendaro clearly establishes that transactions, they don't say if and only if. That language isn't anywhere in Mendaro. They say commercial transactions. None of the cases have overturned that or challenged it.
So I'm clear, this is a case where your client had prior written contracts.
Had prior contracts.
And unjust enrichment extends to the time when he had no such contract.
He was asked to do additional work.
Was any of this additional work time sensitive?
Yes, it was. You know, it was unfolding as the project was moving forward. Loans were getting offered and syndicated. I would also point out that appellant's counsel mentioned that Mr. Vila is in the nature of a consultant is very much like an employee. One of the clear differences that it has and that is reflected in the contract that's in the record is that he wasn't paid on an hourly basis. He was paid on a success fee out of that contract, and there are a number of different ways that they work with consultants. But one of them is that he gets a percentage of loans that he signs. It's a very different kind of relationship than an employee-employer relationship, as well as the fact that he was doing ongoing work and was asked to do more and was told, we'll document it later. And then that never happened. And when he finally asked for payment, they said, oh, we don't have a document. Sorry. it is the kind of case that I think consultants would think twice about. Because as this case, and even as Osirin suggests, that these kinds of things do happen. You know, the protections that are designed in the system aren't always effectuated. And that's exactly what happened here.
Could I just ask you what the uncertainty is in the August 4, 2003 email?
In the August 4, 2003 email?
It's the one that you characterize in the complaint as acknowledging plaintiff's work, mm-hmm. but refusing to compensate it. Mr. Moskosko attempted to justify the refusal to pay, and just suggested entirely new terms for future work.
This is the untranslated email.
The uncertainty in that particular email is you know, pretty certain. My client was at the same time having conversations with other officials at the bank that were describing different possibilities for him to continue to get paid.
And assuming there's some ambiguity in Stephen Reed's first response, the August 28 one, mm-hmm. the September 12 one seems quite firm. Your contract expired last year. I don't understand how you expected compensation on any basis other than a success fee. Mm-hmm. The retainer was eliminated. Compensation after that was based exclusively on a success fee basis. However, even that contract expired in 2002. And then he goes on, I would like to speak with you when I return because I'm completely confounded by your position. Mm-hmm. I guess I can imagine a more complete refusal, but I have a little difficulty doing it.
Well, one aspect of this is that at that point, my client had not presented a bill. He had talked about his compensation, but he hadn't presented a bill for the work that he had done. And I would also just point to the...
No one at IIC seems to be troubled with that.
Right. They're not troubled with him not submitting a bill, but they certainly deny it as soon as he does.
just to say,
the other point, I would call your attention to the district court's opinion denying the motion for certification, where he clearly notes that while this may be an issue, this is a factual issue, and that his reading of the record, as it is, he's made a factual determination.
But he's made the factual determination on the basis of.
Admittedly, an incomplete record, which is fine. But again, that doesn't.
Without a trial,
it doesn't make it right.
It's either on a motion to dismiss, where our review is de novo, or to the extent he looked beyond the complaint, summary judgment, where our review is de novo.
It is. But the point he's making is that this is a factual question, not a legal question.
That may be, but it's still an issue where our review is de novo under the procedural circumstances here.
It may be the case, but as Judge Rogers pointed out in the early part, the facts in the complaint are, you know, to be at this stage
Absolutely.
Of the procedure are to be taken
Absolutely.
As, you know, as they are written. And I would note that the I'll leave it there.
All right. Anything further?
I'm out of time anyway.
All right.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, would you like a minute or two?
Yes.
First, I do want to underscore that there is no contract involved in this appeal. That claim is not before this court. The contract claim is not before this court, and there is no allegation and no argument and no issue with respect to a contract. We are talking about unjust enrichment, and if we're talking about a waiver, what we're considering is whether a waiver for services that that are not within the scope of a contract, whether there's a necessity.
But you can't have it both ways. We're outside of a contract.
Correct.
You're saying, and the allegation is he provided requested services of value.
Correct. The issue of the waiver is whether, in order to, as I believe we're looking at, is whether in order to attract consultants to enter into a contract, they need to have assurance that they may perform services outside of a contract and sue for compensation for those services.
Or maybe another way to put it is whether someone who enters into what he thinks is a valid oral contract needs the assurance of the possibility of an unjust enrichment case if the oral contract fails.
That is a way of articulating it. It's whether they need to be able to perform services and claim payment for them. I would like to address the statute of limitations issue, which I'm glad was raised.
Can I just be sure I'm clear on what your response is to Judge Tatel's point? Because he's made it twice now, and I'm not clear about what your response is.
My response is that, if I understand it correctly, that what we are addressing is the need for assurance that you can sue for services allegedly rendered for the benefit of those services, whether you need that assurance to be willing to enter into a contract for services. And I believe that that's very different, as I've said, from the need to have assurance that you can engage in negotiations and have some recourse with respect to the negotiation process.
See, I thought your response in your brief initially was the type of claim plaintiff is making is of no benefit to the organization because we have contracts for consultants and there's an arbitration provision.
Both is
Judge Tatel's question, as I understand it, goes beyond that and says, all right, I'm a consultant and I'm thinking about working with the organization and I'm happy to enter into this contract. But what happens if for some reason the contract fails?
It to me, if the contract fails, it still doesn't affect whether the consultant has the incentive to enter into the contracts in terms of providing services outside of the contract. And what I'm trying to get across is that I do think the relationship in the Asiron case between the negotiations as critical, as necessary, as essential to entering into the contract itself is extremely different from providing services. You do not need to provide services outside of a contract to enter into, to get to the stage of entering into a contract for services.
Well, but you see,
so it's not a prerequisite.
That's certainly one way to look at it, but as I asked you, and you, I don't think you really answered it, is in this particular case, I think the question is framed differently, and that is whether someone needs the assurance of an unjust enrichment case in order to enter into an oral contract. And it seems to me that, you know, when you look at the language in Osarin and Mendaro, maybe there is a way to draw the line between breach of contract suits and implied breach of contract suits on the one hand and suits based on unjust enrichment following from the failures of those on the other, but I haven't heard that from you yet.
I think perhaps the disconnect has been that the IIC doesn't, as the record fully bears out, doesn't enter into oral contracts with consultants.
Well, that's because you won this particular case, but you know, you could, someone on other facts could bring an implied contract case against the IIC and on different facts perhaps win.
This
only failed according to the district court because of a lack of an agreement on compensation.
That is correct. We haven't addressed the arguments that we would make on the contract issue.
All right. You said you wanted to make one point on the statute of limitations.
Yes, I simply want to state that under either of the two tests that we put forth for determining when the cause of action accrued, it is crystal clear from the complaint that that Vila could have walked into court in August of 2003, certainly by September of 2003, all of the elements of his cause of action existed. He'd completed his services by August of 2003. He allegedly conferred a benefit.
Well, can I ask, would it be possible for the parties to submit a translated version of the August 4, 2003 email, since both parties have focused on it in their briefs and today?
I would think so, yes.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. We will take the case under advisement.
Thank you, Your Honors. Appreciate it.